Fitia, and hello everyone. We have a very special topic for you today and something a little bit different for the podcast overall. We're tracing the history of a birthing technique many of you know about, how it became popular, and how its Soviet origins were largely ignored. We're going to be talking about the Lamaze technique. We have a very special guest of Dr. Paula Michaels, who has written a very brilliant book. So, first and foremost, can you please introduce yourself and your research specialties?
Thanks, Amanda. I'm Paula Michaels. I'm an associate professor of history and the head of history at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. And I work on Soviet history, in particular, the history of medicine in the Soviet Union. And my work, it focuses on situating the trajectory of Soviet medical history in a pan-European and global context.
Great. And we'll be talking about that more later as well, just talking about the research hurdles and the sources that you had to use to even create this book. It's an amazing feat.
That's very generous of you to say. Thank you.
So this is a very, very basic question, but I feel like if people don't quite understand what the Lamaze technique is, then they're not going to quite understand the whole podcast episode. So Paula, would you mind just giving us a quick explanation into what exactly goes into this technique?
So your listeners already know what it is, and they just don't know that's what it's called. Basically, if you've ever seen an American movie or television show in which childbirth is depicted, they always tell the woman to keep breathing. And she's often depicted as doing these kind of patterned, panting breaths. That's the Lamaze method. And what people don't know is, and it's also, sometimes it's called the he-he-he-who method to mimic the pattern of breathing. There were actually many different patterns depending on what stage of labor a woman was in. But the basic idea is that by focusing on these patterns of breathing, you're interfering with the pain signals making their way to the brain.
Right. I'm not going to lie, based off of any medical show I've ever seen, as I have not given child, you know, I haven't had a child myself, that looks extremely painful regardless of the breathing techniques. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about this. So how exactly did you get into this topic? I think, at least for me, as an American woman, I knew what the Lamaze technique, I had at least associated it with essentially not having an epidural during birth, you know, not having any drugs to block the pain. And then that's it. I didn't really think anything much more else of it. What even alerted you to the potential Soviet origins of this technique?
So in the United States, the word Lamaze is a household word. Everyone's heard it, even if they don't know exactly what the technique is. It is, like you say, it's associated with so-called natural childbirth. It's an alternative to getting an epidural. But the way I found out that it had this Soviet backstory was that I was pregnant. And in the year 2000, and like a good researcher and expectant mother, I Googled the word Lamaze because I was looking for prenatal preparatory classes. And so what's the word that you associate with childbirth education classes? It's Lamaze. So I Googled the word Lamaze. It took me to the website of Lamaze International, and there was a link and it said history. And of course, I said, history? I love history. So I clicked on the link, as you do. And the first sentence was, in 1951, French obstetrician Fernand Lamaze traveled to the Soviet Union and there observed this method. And I was like, what? That's crazy. How could I, a historian of medicine in the Soviet Union, not know that this thing that I'd heard about my whole life and now was finally had practical use for actually originated in the Soviet Union? And it was the quest to get to the bottom of that question that led me on this, you know, 8-year odyssey to write that book.
That's
crazy.
Yeah, I mean, just a quick little Google search, and there's a whole book project.
And there's a whole book project, yes.
Well, thank you so much for the introduction to yourself and to the topic. So to get our discussion started today, we're going to be opening with, again, some very basic, but I think important questions in terms of background. So I apologize because there's a slew of them at the beginning, but hopefully I'll become a little bit more restrained as we continue. So to get started off, so why was the Soviet government interested in creating a birthing technique? When and where was the technique pioneered? You know, was it a completely Soviet invention, or were there other influences? And finally, what was the technique called before it was known as Lamaze?
So I'm going to start with the last one, because that explains why I could study Soviet history in such depth for so long and not know this originated there. Because inside the Soviet Union, and actually everywhere except the United States, it was known by the phrase psychoprophylaxis. And it was only in the United States that it became rechristened the Lamaze method, for reasons I'll explain in a minute. But in the Soviet Union, in the city in eastern Ukraine called Kharkiv, there was a group of psychologists who were very interested in the mind-body connection. And they were they did research in the 1920s and 30s and 40s on hypnosis. At the same time, as you and your listeners know, the Soviet Union experienced a demographic catastrophe in World War II. So the government wasn't necessarily interested in creating a childbirth technique. They were interested in getting women to have more babies. And they believed that one of the major obstacles to getting them to do that was the pain of childbirth. So the problem was how to mitigate the pain of childbirth in order to get women to be willing to have more babies. And the solution that most obstetricians supported was nitrous oxide. It was known to be effective. It was pretty simple to administer. There had, since the 1930s, been machines that could dispense a mix of oxygen and nitrous oxide that was regulated by the patient herself, depending on her her demands. And so it was safe. It was effective. It had a history that went back several decades already. The problem was that the Soviet pharmaceutical industry didn't have the capacity to produce enough nitrous oxide and the machines to administer them on a mass scale for all the women that were going to be given birth in the Soviet Union. And so it was in this constrained economic environment in which there is this priority placed on increasing the population that these psychologists in Kharkiv developed this method that was going to take some of the ideas of hypnosis, and in particular, the idea of suggestion, and bring it into a pain management technique that could be taught in group settings. And so it could be done in a way that was cost effective, that didn't require the development of the pharmaceutical industry. And that's why of the options that were available at the time, that's why this is the one that got picked over other choices. It was the cheap option. The other piece of the puzzle here is it was also the ideologically favored one. And I would suggest that this was far less significant than any other factor, but it is worth mentioning that it was justified on the basis of Pavlovian physical psychology. So here, think of the dog salivating at the ringing bell. And by analogy, it's the woman is the dog in this scenario. And she, because it's the Cold War, the idea that something that Pavlov came up with could be, you know, reconfigured or applied in this setting gave it a sort of ideological good housekeeping seal of approval that made it both politically palatable at the same time as it was economically feasible.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense, though. I think as a woman and most women everywhere, we really wish we weren't necessarily the dog in the scenario.
Yes, it's not an attractive analogy. It really isn't. But at the same time, the Soviets were not alone in this. At the same time, there was this other guy. So my main protagonist, his name is Velvovsky. In the UK at the same time, there was a guy named Grantley Dick Reed. And he is someone who's well known across the Anglophone world. And he had been writing on the topic of managing pain in labor without pain medication in the 1930s. But he really got a lot more uptake amid the baby boom in the mid 1940s. And his ideas were very similar, but a little bit different. They did not invoke Pavlovian physical psychology. There's no dogs and rain bells in his scenario. He believed that childbirth was a naturally painless process, and the pain of childbirth is entirely in women's minds. So, I mean, it defies logic. It is no coincidence, I suspect, that all of these various theories are being put forward by men. It's like, I'd like to see them, you know, push a baby out. It's obviously not without pain. But the idea was that Grantley Dick Reed's idea was that, you know, women are told it's going to be painful. Therefore, they expect pain. They physically tense up. They tense up their cervix. And that's what it's like. I don't know about you, but I do not have that level of control over my cervix.
Nope.
But they tense up their cervix, and, you know, tense woman, tense cervix, painful labor is the idea. It's what he called the fear, tension, pain cycle. And so he had a somewhat different way of explaining the process, but a similar sort of psychologizing about women's pain being located not in their bodies, but in their minds. My Soviet protagonists were not aware of Grantley Dick Reed's work. And even though later he went on to say that they robbed him of his ideas and that, you know, they never had any original thoughts of their own, there is no evidence that they knew about his writings until they had published their own.
Yeah, that would make sense. The Soviet Union was largely closed off from other, you know, periodicals and stuff like that, where I'd imagine Dick Lee Reed would have published, if he did, I'm assuming he did, his own findings. So...
Well, he's most well known for a book, and that book was not translated into Russian. It was not, there's no evidence it was circulating in the Soviet Union. They were just on a different wavelength, and he was not publishing in the kind of venues that these guys would have been publishing in or following. So, you know, they did access Western medical journals, but they would have been looking in psychology and psychiatry journals, and he was a physician, obstetrician. And so they were just traveling in different circles, but that did not stop him from thinking this to be a communist plot to rip him off.
Of course. I mean, we'll just boil it all down to that.
As you do. Yes.
Great. So again, so really, I think really important background in terms of going forwards. How did the Soviet Union then implement this technique once it was chosen? Who was, I guess, spreading the word? Was it popular? And then, of course, I think the ever-present question of, were there any issues with, you know, with the technique itself and or spreading awareness of it?
Yeah, the technique was far more popular abroad than it was at home. And one of the ironies of my project was that when I was in Kharkov researching this, there were people from USAID who were developing childbirth preparation materials that you drew on materials from Lamaze International. And they did not know that they were in the home of this technique. And it had been, and none of the locals knew, because it had been so completely forgotten from the history of the Soviet Union. So the Ministry of Public Health was charged with setting up an education campaign to train midwives in this technique so that they could then train expectant mothers. But the big problem was that midwives didn't believe that this was really effective, and that made them not very good messengers. So it's a bit of a catch-22, because what we don't know is, if they had had greater faith in it, would they have then been better at delivering the message of it to women, and therefore it would have worked better? We can't answer that counterfactual. But what we do know is that there were a lot of problems administering it, both because the midwives didn't believe in it, And because the mothers didn't believe in it, you know, which was a message that they were in part getting from the midwives themselves. But as problematic was the fact that a lot of women didn't have the time in their days to train in this method. So if you think about all the weight of the double burden for Soviet women who were working outside the home, but also maintaining the home, might have other children, you know, had to get to and from work, had to do the shopping, all of that left little time to invest in training in a method that they didn't choose, that they were being told to prepare for, and that they didn't really believe in. And that stands in really stark contrast with the uptake in Western Europe, which was consumer driven. And so there's, you know, this, the failure of it to really take root in the Soviet Union itself, despite being in 1951 mandated as national policy, the official Soviet method of giving birth, it never really got hold and was pretty much a flop. What it was much more effective for doing was serving as propaganda overseas for the benevolence of the Soviet state. Like, look at this wonderful thing that Comrade Stalin has done for Soviet women, that there they now give birth without pain. Oh, wow. That was a message that was really well received by communists overseas, in France in particular. But at home, it was kind of a flop that never really got off the ground. And then in 1956, when the Soviet Union, you know, things were changing, the secret speech was read, there was a big conference on psychoprophylaxis. And it was basically a battle between the psychologists who were in favor of this method and obstetricians who were like, dudes, this does not work. What we need is nitrous oxide. Nitrous oxide works. And actually, it's the obstetricians that triumphed at that conference. And while psychoprophylaxis continued to be taught, and there was some research in it into the 1960s, and it was on the books as officially, you know, part of childbirth preparation in the Soviet Union, right down through the USSR's demise, it basically just existed on paper.
I mean, to be fair, I'm actually kind of surprised that the obstetricians won, just given how, I think, sometimes how a lot of us perceive the Soviet government in guarding its resources, particularly in, I think, when it comes to medical practice. Like, I know in my own research with the abortion, you know, they technically, it's supposed to be under anesthesia, but most of the time it never is, because they say that they're hoarding, essentially, all of the anesthesia for what they call, quote, important things.
Right. Well, let me clarify that when I say the obstetricians won, I mean that the obstetricians won in the sense that if there was to be pain relief, that the preferred method would be nitrous oxide, but it was almost never available.
Right. Okay.
So in practice, women did not benefit from that win. They won they won a medical argument. They did not win a material argument in the maternity wards.
Right. That sadly makes more sense.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Okay. You've answered the question of maybe how did women find this technique. Actually, can you maybe go more into how it was taught? So you've mentioned that women would have to take extra time out of their very, very busy schedule already. Was it like a series of classes, kind of like how it is today, or?
Exactly. Yeah. So there were these group classes. They would attend them at the maternity clinic where they would eventually give birth. They were much more narrow than they came to be much more elaborate, especially in the United States, in terms of the number of classes and the detail and, you know, the different kinds of patterns of breathing that were taught. That expanded in the U.S. In the Soviet Union, it was more stripped down, and they would take, you know, approximately, it varied from year to year, but about half a dozen classes in preparation. There would be posters that would explain the process of childbirth and what women could expect during the different stages of labor. And they would teach them these patterns of breathing that they were then supposed to go home and practice. It's worth noting that in contrast to our popular imagination of the Lamaze method being used, the husband is not present. That's an advent that happens actually in France in the 1950s. And that it then merges with Grantley Dick Reed was in favor of having husbands present. And so those things come together in the United States and you get the development of something that's called husband coached childbirth, which is also known as the Bradley method, that really puts a lot of emphasis on the role that the husband plays as an almost para medical, kind of extension of the medical team. None of that is present in the Soviet context, where men leave their partners at the threshold of the maternity ward. And as they did in, most of the United States in the 1950s, go off to a waiting room, or in the Soviet Union, they would hang out outside the maternity ward and be, smoking with the other men. So these were women who would then theoretically use this method. Women gave birth in the Soviet Union in a group setting, like you didn't have private delivery rooms like you do in the United States for the most part. In this same period, you might have multiple women laboring in a room at the same time. And so the idea that you're going to have the presence of mind in labor while other women are also laboring to focus on this pattern breathing, as someone who had a child, I assure you that is a very tall order. Like the idea that you could have that kind of mental capacity amid the physical demands of labor, it's very hard for me to imagine that that could have been something common.
As I said, I do not have a child yet, but like that is, I can't even imagine that. I can't imagine that being comfortable or even useful, especially if one person breaks, then like, how are you even supposed to have concentration? And, I think we can.
Right. And it's not, none of this, it's important to remember, like my psychologists who developed the method in Kharkov, they did it under very controlled and atypical circumstances. So they were never able, when other researchers tried to replicate their findings in terms of the success rate of the pain being manageable or non-existent, then, they were not able to duplicate it because the Velvovsky's team didn't work in those sorts of conditions. And the conditions Velvovsky worked in were much closer to the ones that we see when we look at the methods application in France or Great Britain and the United States, interestingly, where his results were able to be duplicated. But even there, the aspiration of the method is different as well. So Velvovsky was quite explicit that this method eliminated pain. And it was in other times and places, the objective was not the elimination of pain, but the management of pain. So it's interesting how even as the core idea and technique is pretty static, actually remarkably static across time and place, what they were trying to achieve with it differed. But whether it was the total elimination of pain or just the management of it, neither of those things really ever took off on a large scale in the Soviet Union, because neither the material conditions were there, nor was there a kind of groundswell of popular support for it. It was mandated from above rather than driven from below.
Right. Okay. So speaking of France, so how did Dr. Lamaze, so how did the-
Who is this guy?
Who is this guy? How did he come to be known as the Lamaze technique? And how do you even find out about this?
Yes. So in 1951, a Soviet obstetrician named Nikolaev traveled to France and gave a conference paper there on the method of psychoprophylaxis. And Lamaze was in the audience. And Lamaze was like, whoa, that is pretty amazing. I'd like to know more about that. Now, who was Lamaze? He was a French obstetrician. He was interested in mind-body medicine. He had done some training in psychiatry. And he had two practices. One was at the Metallurgical Workers Union Hospital, which was run by the communists. The union was run by the communists, and which is not, you know, weird in France in the late 40s, early 50s. And he also had a private practice where like well-heeled Parisian women went. So like very different demographics.
Yeah.
But because of his connections at the Metallurgical Workers Union, they sponsored a trip to the Soviet Union that gave French doctors an opportunity to see what was going, all the wonders of building socialism in the Soviet Union. And so he then went in 1953 to the Soviet Union, and he insisted at every opportunity that he wanted to witness a birth using this method. And he just like banged on about this relentlessly. And on the last day of his trip, they gave him the chance to do that at a clinic in Leningrad.
I'm sure they loved and it. The women loved that.
Can you imagine being the woman who had to give birth in the room with like a random French obstetrician? Like, how weird is that? And we know nothing about her. We don't know her name. We don't know her age. We don't know anything about her birth experience. We know she was a typist. That's literally the only information we have about her.
Of course, and her job.
But it's, you know, it's like, it's such a typical story of like the invisibility of both like the woman, of course, but also even the patient, right? Like in medical history, there's so much focused on the practitioners that sometimes the experience of the patient is hard to render visible. We can imagine, though, that it would have been, you know, surely somebody would have spoken to her about who this guy was and how she had to behave appropriately in front of this foreigner who had come to see this method used. But what we see is the story written from Lamaze's perspective. He wrote about that encounter. And what he said is that, you know, not a bead of sweat appeared on her forehead. And it's like, really?
Oh,
that is hard to believe. But he had this kind of conversion experience in which he was like, well, this is just the greatest thing since sliced baguettes. And I am going to bring this back to France and turn the world, on its axis and off its axis. And he went back to the Metallurgical Workers Union Hospital, and he's like, guys, I saw this awesome thing. I'm paraphrasing here, right? Guys, I saw this awesome thing and we should totally do it. And they're like, huh, we're super into the Soviet Union and we will support this because it makes communism look good. And so they promoted it in their hospital. And that hospital, which is kind of colloquially known as Les Bleuets, is became this epicenter of instruction for the world on this method that actually originated in the Soviet Union. So people from, you know, North Africa and the Levant and, you know, East Asia and North America came to study at this hospital, this method that originated in the Soviet Union and that Lamaze brought over. And it was still called psychoprophylaxis. He then, in his private practice, had an American patient named Marjorie Carmel, who was an actress who was living as an expatriate in France with her husband. And she had a fabulous experience using this method. And she wrote a book, and her book is called Thank You, Dr. Lamaze. And it's still in print. And it's because his name was in the title, it got currency in the United States. Right. And it was less cumbersome than saying psychoprophylaxis, which is actually quite a mouthful.
Yeah.
And so they rebranded it in the US, the Lamaze method, as a way to give it, to distance it from its Soviet origins, to make it something easier to pronounce. And I personally think also to give it what I like to call Euro cachet. It sounded all French. And of course, Americans like love things that are French because they're fancy.
It's very true. It's very weird. Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, so much information in a really wonderful, accessible way. So, but in terms of, so in this kind of rechristening, were there any necessarily differences between, you know, the psychoprophylaxis? See, I definitely recognize the word when I read it in Russian, because one, it's long, and also it's just so unique, I think, in some of the, anyways, that's a side point. But in the rechristening of this, you know, are there now differences between the Soviet version and, you know, what we now maybe associate with the Lamaze technique for birthing?
Totally.
Okay.
So, so first let me just say that when the method moved to France, there was a kind of orthodoxy around it. And the major French innovation was to bring the father into the picture. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it was pretty much unchanged compared to the Soviet Union. And when it came to the United States, unlike in France, it came into an environment in which there was already some similar ideas circulating because they had arrived from Great Britain. So you had Grantley Dick Reed's book had already been published in the United States. There was, and he had a following in the United States. The Marjorie Carmel book was published in, I think, 1961. And so it's already more than a decade that Grantley Dick Reed's ideas about natural childbirth, as he called it, were circulating. And so when psychoprophylaxis came into that environment, it really, you have in across the 1960s and into the 70s, a sort of tussle going on between these two methods and the partisans for each of these methods that are really in some ways quite similar in the, certainly in their objective and somewhat in their method. Dick Reed's method, they didn't have all the fancy breathing techniques. There was a lot more emphasis on prenatal calisthenics, you know, women developing like flexibility and, you know, being more physically fit. So they would kind of like a physical therapy sort of dimension to it. Both methods emphasize the calming presence of the father. And then what you have in the US is they begin to come together. And so in the US, the phrase natural childbirth comes to be a sort of generic for these non-pharmacological ways of managing pain and labor, the not using pharmacological pain relief or any other kind of interventions like, to strengthen contractions, for example, or to induce labor. Mm-hmm. So the phrase natural childbirth goes from being a specific label for Grantley Dick Reed's method with like capital N and capital C to being a generic for all the very many different approaches that are used. The other thing that happens in the United States is that it becomes enmeshed with the feminist movement, with second wave feminism. And one of my earliest questions when I started this was, how the heck did something that I associate with second wave feminism originate in Stalin's Soviet Union? Because if there was one thing I was pretty confident I knew, it's that bourgeois feminism was not high on Stalin's to-do list. So I was like, this is crazy. Like, where did this marriage come from between that kind of ideology and this technique that clearly has nothing to do with that? And so in the United States, you have this coincidence in, or not coincidence necessarily, but this this sort of happy coincidence between the feminist movement, which is about, you know, women's empowerment, and part of that is about women taking charge of their own bodies. Mm-hmm. And this method comes along in which that would liberate women from dependence on physicians and dependence on, like, you know, on anesthetists or anesthesiologists, as they're called in the United States, liberating women from that dependence on the medicalist, the male medical establishment, is kind of a happy side effect of this method, even though the method itself has nothing intrinsically liberationist about it. And in fact, what I try to argue in the book is that the method really has its origins in a way being a way of controlling women's behavior without using pharmacological pain relief. It's about getting them to be quiet and compliant, and not to say that that's not what they were choosing, mm-hmm. But that's not the same thing. It's a different vision of what giving birth using this method looks like. So in our imagination, when we think about the Lamaze mother, you said at the very beginning, you know, it looks very painful. Childbirth looks very painful. But if you look at video footage of that, like, you know, instructional videos from the 50s and early 60s, that's not what childbirth looks like using this method. It's like eerily quiet, and women are perfectly still, and they're talking as if nothing is happening, right? They're like, oh, I think I'll have a spot of tea. Like, that's literally right out of a Grantley Dick Reed movie. It's crazy. But it's when it becomes enmeshed with feminism, and it's about this, like, recovery of women's bodies and control of their bodies, that giving birth this way becomes a more less detached and a more deeply embodied experience. So not only, so even as the technique is pretty stable, the look and sound of it as practice is quite dramatically different.
Right. So it switches from being very still to, I guess, releasing the pain.
Yeah. So it goes from being about eliminating pain to being about coping with pain.
Right.
And then it goes from being about, you know, this kind of detached, placid demeanor to being this sort of, like, you know, mother goddess, roar, you know, kind of deeply embodied experience.
Anytime anyone says goddess, it just makes me think of Parks and Rec and Leslie Knope and the Pawnee goddesses. And like, that is exactly what they would espouse if, you know. Anyways, so we've talked about a lot of the popularity, a lot of the benefits that many, you know, groups and women, you know, found in this. Were there any critiques of the Lamaze method, you know, as it was being implemented?
So many critiques. And one of the core problems is that for a lot of women, it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So I've met many, many women who raved about their Lamaze experience. And I met many, many women who, and I've certainly read plenty of writings by women who described it as a ripoff, was the phrase that they used, that they felt they'd been duped to believe that this would help them. And then they had a terrible, painful, truly traumatic birth experience in which they came out of it feeling like they had failed in some way. And one article in the Village Voice described it as a shock, which I actually had to look up what that even meant, but it's some kind of like a swindle. In the United States, there was what arose was like a really kind of partisan divide between people in for and against it, and for reasons that changed over time. So at the very beginning, I had hoped to find that there were rabid anti-communists who were against this because it came from the Soviet Union. And to be honest, I really struggled to find even a shred of information that evidence that suggested that. There's like a little tiny, tiny bit, but that was never significant. And actually in 1956, the Pope weighed in on the question. And because some obstetricians asked him, well, what do you think of these things, the Dick Reed method and psychoprophylaxis? And he basically said, just as we humans are allowed to use tools to make our labor in the fields easier, these are also tools, and they're totally fine. As long as a woman is fully conscious when she's giving birth, if she can use her mind to conquer the pain, that's all right. And then he was asked, well, what about the fact that this thing started in the Soviet Union and they're all godless communists? And again, a paraphrase, but he basically said, even a broken clock is right twice a day. Like, just because the communists came up with it, I mean, they've got lots of terrible ideas, but this one isn't one of them. So what the heck? Why not? So once the Pope gives it his seal of approval, then it's that sort of like anti-communist edge to it, to opposition, really drops away. More vocal is the opposition that's based on there's some medical opposition. They think, you know, women are being misled about what's capable. Physicians don't want to lose control over the what's happening in the delivery room. Some are reluctant to allow fathers in to witness the birth of their children. And so there are fights around opening the process up to this method, and, you know, giving that the decision about whether or not a woman gets pain relief should be her choice. There's a fight about that. And so all of those are battles that have to unfold. By the 1970s, there's a lot more resistance coming from women themselves. A lot more stories begin circulating about women having bad experiences and being, you know, sold a bag of goods. And in France, what's very interesting is that the feminist battle cry in France is not for psychoprophylaxis, it's for pharmacological pain relief, because this method has so taken off there that it's used pretty much everywhere. And whereas in the United States, it comes to signify resistance to the medical establishment, in France, it is part of the medical establishment, and resistance and, you know, feminist empowerment and women taking charge of their own bodies means women getting the right to choose to have pharmacological pain relief. So you have a completely 180 opposite storyline in France versus the United States in terms of what's, you know, where those battle lines are drawn.
That's fascinating on so many levels. Just a quick question as well, kind of backtracking a little bit. Did people, you know, in terms of when you were saying that you were hoping to find pretty much mostly Americans who were really, really against the Lamaze technique because of its Soviet origins, did people widely know that it, you know, had Soviet origins, or did they not care?
What is clear is that Marjorie Carmel, who wrote that book, Thank You, Dr. Lamaze, yep, she got together with a couple of other people. One of them was Elizabeth Bing, who is a very famous childbirth educator in the United States and author of books on the topic. And they founded the American Society for Psychoprophylaxis in Obstetrics, or ASPO, which is now known as Lamaze International. Okay. And that organization, which spearheaded the development of this method in the US, they never hid the fact that it originated in the Soviet Union. So all through the decades, there's always fleeting mentions of this story that I encountered about its origins in the Soviet Union, but they didn't dwell on it either. And they did discuss the need to not dwell on it in order to not draw attention to those Soviet origins. But there's it just doesn't matter is the bottom line. And mostly what the rhetoric around it is that women cared whether it worked or not. There's actually a British source where, you know, you have these hard line supporters of Grantley Dick Reed getting into these battles with these emerging support for psychoprophylaxis. And the common sense response from the National Childbirth Trust was, women don't care about these ideological divides. They care about whether it's effective or not. And the reality is that people, at least, we don't, not that it was more effective, but people believed that the Lamaze method was more effective. And it was framed in the kind of persuasive language of science. So they did clinical trials and they used the language of Pavlovian physical psychology, and it gave it a sort of aura of science that Dick Reed never had. And so that's kind of what gave it an edge over that.
Interesting. Okay. So you mentioned sources. So now we're going to move away from the fascinating topic, but also maybe talk about how you managed to track down the content, because in your book, you know, you have, so obviously the Soviet Union, which constituted 15 different republics. So you obviously talked about Ukraine. I'm assuming you also went to Moscow to, yeah, so,
yes.
So Ukraine, Russia, the UK, the US, and France. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, that's a lot of, it's a lot of archives and a lot of travel. So how yes. did you manage to, so, okay, so let me slow it down. So how did you even manage to find out where you needed to go to get these sources? And then also, what were the sources that you used to create this book?
Right. So in the case of France, I'll start there. There already was a little bit of secondary literature on the topic. And there's a woman, Marlène Voy, who is Swiss, who actually had written and published about the Lamaze method. And she was the first one who went into the archives of the Metallurgist Workers Union and indexed the folders relating to Lamaze. And it was in through her footnotes that I found out where those papers were. And then I corresponded with her, and she was incredibly generous. And there's a bit of a cottage industry of people who are working on psychoprophylaxis in various countries. So there's people who are studying it in Czech Republic, in Spain, in places in Latin America, all over the world, in China, somebody's writing about it in China. So there's lots of kind of bubbling activity about it all over the place, but the people working on France were in the vanguard and did a lot of the legwork for me. And it was through them and their assistance that I was able to learn where to go to find necessary things. And in the United States, it was also pretty straightforward, because the papers of Lamaze International, which is an obvious place to start, were housed at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard. And I also went to other archives that had relevant materials, but that's the most important collection for the US side of things. In the case of Great Britain, the National Childbirth Trust is the other obvious place to look for things, which was a little more complicated because when I started my research, it was still in the hands of the National Childbirth Trust. It has since been transferred to Wellcome. And it has now been fully cataloged. That was not the case. Like when I went, it was like in their basement, you know, in boxes and a little bit random in a kind of out of the way corner of London. So in the Soviet Union, the Ministry of Public Health is the obvious place to look for such things. And then within the files of the Ministry of Public Health, there's a section on maternal and child health. And then because I basically had this one word, right, psychoprophylactica, like basically I could just like, you know, look through folders trying to find this word. And so what it did was allow me this like point of entry into like a vast realm of documentation, but in a highly focused way. So while the Ministry of Public Health is an enormous collection, I was interested in something very, very specific. And there were folders that had the word psychoprophylaxis in the title. And then I knew it originated in Kharkiv. And so I went to Kiev, I went to Kharkiv, and probably the most important find I had there was in Kiev, there was the 900 page transcript of this 1956 conference where they had these arguments. And that was just an absolute goldmine of information. So it's a mix of looking for low-hanging fruit in really obvious places, getting incredibly lucky, benefiting from the generosity of the scholars who came before me, which is, you know, something that I feel incredibly fortunate to have been able to avail myself of. And then also trying to like beat the bushes for less obvious places here and there. But even if I had not done that, the kind of core foundation of it was there. I would like to take the opportunity to also say one other thing, since I just mentioned the generosity of other scholars. Roberta Manning, who was a wonderful historian of rural Russia at Boston College for many decades, she is the one who first suggested to me to not just make it a history of this method in the Soviet Union, but to follow it to France and then the United States. She's the one who knew that trajectory because she had been a Lamaze mother in Boston in the 1970s. And I was all like, oh, I don't know. What do I know about European history? I'm not an Americanist. I can't even read French. And she's like, no, no, that's the story to tell. And you should go learn French. It's not that hard. And and so I did, you know, and really Roberta Manning, I would just like, I mean, she's passed away a few years ago, but she was a wonderfully generous scholar who deserves credit for the genesis of this book.
Yeah, I mean, and she was clearly right. It's an amazing story to tell. So I guess, so finally, in kind of conclusion to wrapping up this episode, so if there was one thing that you would want people to take away, you know, from this episode, what would it be?
I would say that there are many stories to be told about every topic, right? And we all make choices about which story we're going to tell. And the Soviet story about this episode, by putting the Soviet Union into this picture, it changes what we think the story is about feminism, about the meaning that we inscribe on childbirth, and about women's, you know, how we understand even our own birth experiences. When we look at this story and trace it back to these Soviet origins and then follow the methods, permutations, and shifting meanings in different national contexts, it reminds us that nothing about it is like intrinsically empowering to women to give birth one way or another. And, you know, maybe in that, there's, you know, yes, there's a lesson here about doing Soviet history in a way that's in dialogue with the Soviet experiences, with what's happening in other places. But it's also about our own experiences and putting those in a bigger picture and maybe letting go of some of the meanings we attach to our own experiences and think about how those are actually historically constructed.
That's great. Thank you so much. I will also post a link to this wonderful book in terms of where you can buy it, but we have been talking largely about Dr. Paula Michael's Lamaze and International History by Oxford University Press. And so thank you so much for just this wonderful discussion, enlightening us, you know, on something that, as you said, is a household name in many places. But clearly, you know, we didn't know the whole story.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda. I appreciate it.
And a final thank you to our guest, Dr. Paula Michaels. I'm a big fan of her work and of the Lamaze book particularly. Actually, that book was one of the very first books I read when I was a master's student several years ago. But we won't talk about that. And Soviet Sex is still looking for more special topic speakers. Please get in touch with me on Twitter at SexSoviet or email me at SovietSexPodcast@gmail.com. Finally, don't forget to check out our super cool website with all of the links at SovietSexPodcast@wordpress.com. Thanks also to our listeners. I and the entire Soviet Sex Podcast team really, really appreciate you continuing to stream, download, and listen to the podcast. Keep your eyes and ears out for our next special topics episode, which will drop in the next couple of weeks. And in the meantime, до свидания, everybody!